TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Kevin Anderson, Talk to the Oxford Climate Society. Opening with Greta Thunberg. In August 2018, at age 15, Greta Thunberg started the first school strike for climate outside the Swedish parliament. She skipped classes and maintained a regular presence every Friday. At first, Greta Thunberg was often alone, but slowly her presence was noticed, even outside Sweden, and by the time she addressed the United Nations Climate Change Conference in December 2018 in Poland, and the World Economic Forum at Davos, Switzerland, in January 2019, her courageous and well-researched talks were seen by hundreds of thousands via the internet. When she came to Brussels, Belgium, the school strike movement was already in full swing there with weekly walkouts. And she called seven young student organizers on the stage with her, Greta Thunberg, speaking to European Union politicians in Brussels.
Tens of thousands of children are school striking for the climate on the streets of Brussels. Hundreds of thousands are doing the same all over the world. We are school striking because we have done our homework. And some of us are here today. People always tell us that they are so hopeful. They are hopeful that the young people are going to save the world. But we are not. There is simply not enough time to wait for us to grow up and become the ones in charge. Because by the year 2020, we need to have bended the emissions curve steep downwards. That is next year. We know that most politicians don't want to talk to us. Good. We don't want to talk to them either. We want them to talk to the scientists instead. Listen to them. Because we are just repeating what they are saying and have been saying for decades. We want you to follow the Paris Agreement and the IPCC report. We don't have any other manifests or demands. Just unite behind the science. That is our demand. Once you have done your homework, you realize that we need new politics. We need new economics where everything is based on a rapidly declining and extremely limited remaining carbon budget. But that is not enough. We need a whole new way of thinking. The political system that you have created is all about competition. You cheat when you can because all that matters is to win, to get power. That must come to an end. We must stop competing with each other. We need to cooperate and work together and to share the resources of the planet in a fair way. We need to start living within the planetary boundaries, focus on equity, and take a few steps back for the sake of all living species. We need to protect the biosphere, the air, the oceans, the soil, the forests. This may sound very naive, but if you have done your homework, then you know that we don't have any other choice. We need to focus every inch of our being on climate change, because if we fail to do so, then all our achievements and progress have been for nothing. And all that will remain of our political leaders' legacy will be the greatest failure of human history. And they will be remembered as the greatest villains of all time because they have chosen not to listen and not to act. This does not have to be. There is still time. According to the IPCC report, we are about 11 years away from being in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction beyond human control. To avoid that, unprecedented changes in all aspects of society need to have taken place within this coming decade, including a reduction of our CO2 emissions by at least 50% by the year 2030. And please note that those numbers do not include the aspect of equity, which is absolutely necessary to make the Paris Agreement work on a global scale. Nor do they include tipping points or feedback loops, like the extremely powerful methane gas released from the thawing Arctic permafrost. They do, however, include negative emission techniques on a huge planetary scale that is yet to be invented, and that many scientists fear will never be ready in time, and will anyway be impossible to deliver at the scale assumed. If the EU is to make its fair contribution to staying within the carbon budget for the 2-degree limit, then it needs a minimum of 80% reduction by 2030. And that includes aviation and shipping. So around twice as ambitious as the current proposal. The actions required are beyond manifestos or any party politics. Some people say that we are fighting for our future, but that is not true. We are not fighting for our future, we are fighting for everyone's future. And if you think that we should be in school instead, then we suggest that you take our place in the streets, striking from your work. Or better yet, join us so we can speed up the process. And I am sorry, but saying everything will be all right while continue doing nothing at all is just not hopeful to us. In fact, it's the opposite of hope. And yet, this is exactly what you keep doing. You can't just sit around waiting for hope to come. Then you're acting like spoiled, irresponsible children. You don't seem to understand that hope is something you have to earn. And if you still say that we are wasting valuable lesson time, then let me remind you that our political leaders have wasted decades through denial and inaction. And since our time is running out, we have decided to take action. We have started to clean up your mess, and we will not stop until we are done. Thank you.
That was Greta Thunberg speaking to European Union politicians in Brussels. As I'm recording this, the call is out for March 15, 2019, worldwide walkout of students, including in the US. And here is the conclusion of the talk to the Oxford Climate Society by Professor Kevin Anderson, the chair of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, UK. He said in part one, imagine if the world's top 10% carbon emitters were to reduce their carbon footprint to the average European, there would be about a one-third cut in global emissions. End quote. Targeting the top emitters is very much in line with Anderson's respect for climate equity and justice. Here's what he has to say about energy efficiency standards.
In the near to medium term, we need really tight efficiency standards. On the demand side, you can make rapid changes in emissions, but you can only do that if you've got policies to stop the rebound effects. You know, energy efficiency has never brought a reduction in anything. It almost always feeds into economic growth. So efficiency benefits overall just help you grow your economy, help you increase your emissions. But that doesn't mean to say that it has to do that. You could put policies in there to help overcome that. You know, progressive metering tariffs. There's a whole suite of things you could do, but we've never done that historically. But if you look at something like an A-rated refrigerator, and then look at an A++++ refrigerator for the same size, there's between a 60 and 80% difference in energy consumption. 60 to 80%. So why are we selling rubbish A-rated refrigerators? Because we have a liberalized choice system, so we can buy crap if we really want to. But if you just said, well, the standard's got to be an A++++ this year, next year it has to be 10% better, and the year after that 10% better, you could very rapidly change energy on the demand side. Same with cars. Why is it we're selling cars at 200 and 250 grams when you can buy an IC engine, a internal combustion engine car, at 85 to 100 grams, even with the VW scams? You can still get cars at much lower that will take three children's seats in the back and, you know, still do 70 or 80 miles an hour on the motorway. So why are we selling ones with high grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour? If you put standards in to drive these things, you would rapidly shift things through. About 60 to 80% of all the vehicle kilometres travelled in the UK, and for most of the EU countries this is true, are travelled by cars that are under 8 years old. So it takes very little time to percolate through the system if you change demand with policies around it to stop the rebound effect. And the rebound effect is important because you find in the EU, we've had no reduction in transport fuel emissions over the last few years, and we've had an increase in the US over the last year. So efficiency, really important. And of course, we have to do the thing that we always talk about, energy supply. Energy supply is massively important, but it cannot deliver in the time frame we want. And therefore, you have to do these things here. So it's, I sort of call it like a Marshall-style construction of Europe. I mean, obviously, the Marshall Plan came with all quite nasty other issues in it politically, but the actual sort of infrastructure change is what I'm talking about, that scale of change. And even that wouldn't be as big as what we'd have to make. So this is like energy supply and massive electrification. Remember, only 20% of the final energy we consume, not the primary, it's always worth separating those two. Of the final energy we consume, only 20% is electricity. 80% of it is not electricity. So you've got to have a massive level of electrification, probably a threefold, if not fourfold, increase in electrification. What we're saying, regardless whether you're, you know, whether you're a socialist or a rabid laissez-faire type, the basic maths tell you here to change the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure of the world in which we live. So it's just like Roosevelt going in, you know, and telling the companies they've got to change what they were doing. It's just like us introduced rationing in the Second World War. You have to start to say we've got a limited amount of resources, a limited amount of labour, and they've got to be doing the things like this if we're going to respond to climate change. And this is even if you have big improvements in efficiency and reductions in energy demand. The UK is about 1,800 terawatt hours. So I would think you could probably get it down to something like 1,000 to 1,200 terawatt hours. Just remember it's 1,800. So when people start talking about electricity at 300 to 330, just remember what the real figures are. So this is a shift in productive capacity, I would argue, at least similar to what we saw in World War II. There are very, very few parallels out there. The sort of shift we're talking about, you can't use acid rain or ozone or any of these things. Probably have to go right back to things like the abolition of slavery. Yeah, slavery was the principal structure by which we ran our economies in the US and much of Europe. And when it was abolished, that took a long time. Very sadly, what we had to do was actually we ended up compensating the slave owners, which I find quite reprehensible. We may have to think about how do we do that now? How do you compensate the Saudi Arabias, the Qatars, the BPs, the Shells? Do we have to do that? Is that going to be part of our solution? I'm really uncomfortable about that. But maybe lessons in history tell us we can't just make that change without thinking about those things. I hope we can find a way around that. We are talking about changes that are only have occurred in sort of post-Enlightenment on a handful of occasions. Maybe, you know, the emancipation of women and universal suffrage is another one. But there are very few of these examples. And the sorts of shifts I'm talking about are, you know, all the things that as academics, and know if you come to Oxford, you're desperate trying to do this anyway. So you come here to get a good education, so you can get a good job, to get more money, so you can buy more stuff and have a higher carbon footprint. That's the main reason you come to Oxford. I know that's not completely true. I bet I can guarantee most of the time, 10 years from now, you'll have a higher carbon footprint than you have now. 10 years after that, it'll be higher again. Large houses, holiday homes, second homes, prestige cars, SUVs, multiple car ownerships, highly mobile lives. Academics love that, be flying around the world at taxpayers' expense. Frequent flyers, business class, first travel, high levels of consumer goods. You know, all the things that we aspire to, all the things that our world tells us, yeah, this is about prestige. This tells us we're doing something right. But the resources going to provide these, this is a huge proportion of our resources, which is why you see this when you look at the emissions curves. The reason the emissions are in this particular group is because that's where the resources are. So let's not pretend the resources are sort of spread out amongst the poor. They're not. They're highly concentrated in a particular small group of society that includes me. And we need those resources, that labour and materials to help us make this transformation from an 81% fossil fuel energy system to a zero fossil fuel energy infrastructure in 20 years. This is a zero carbon industrial strategy. This is hugely challenging. Way beyond, I think, anything that anyone is yet contemplating, really. I can see why people say this is just not possible. We're not going to deliver this. And I think we're on the cusp of failing on this and heading somewhere pretty appalling. But I think there are some early signs of possible deep system change. And I wrote this, I thought about this when I was coming back from Bonn, which was an appalling event. Katowice was much better than Bonn. Bonn was just terrible. The COP a couple of years ago. But whether you're a politician, a scientist, academic, business people, journalists, or civil society, we're all going to hell in a handcart at the moment. We're all going somewhere which we don't want to be. There's virtually no positive stories out there at any large-scale collective level. That's not to say that we're awash with lots of positive stories at smaller scales, but we're not seeing anything at a large scale, which is why the emissions keep going up. So is there light in despair? And when I was coming back from Bonn, I was on the train back up from Bonn, back up to Sweden, which is where I worked part of the time, and I was quite depressed, so I was trying to write something cathartic to try and lift my mood on the train. And I had a couple of days to do it. So I wrote something which then got picked up by The Conversation and was published by them. It's also on my website. And it was just hope from chaos. Could political upheaval lead to a new green epoch? And it is, you know, desperately looking at straws to grab. But are there any straws to grab, and are they reasonable to think about? And I was thinking about post-2008 at the time. It's 10 years. What are the things we might have seen? The banking crisis, quantitative easing. Go back to 2006, even halfway through 2007, and say to chancellors, just say to all the economic pontificators that we'd like the government to write a cheque for £500 trillion. They'd think you were mad. They were doing it a year later. No shortage of money. Okay, well, not all of it was real. Some of it was fabricated. But most of this money was spent on resources one way or another. So overnight, the UK managed to find... Well, it found about £250 billion overnight, and it took a little bit longer to find the other £500 billion. So it found huge quantities of money. And it could have used that, like Korea and China did in part, to help drive a sort of greening infrastructure. It didn't. They just squandered it in its usual sort of reckless fashion. But we had a huge amount of money. It could have helped us retrofit the houses, done a lot with our energy system. And that's not just here, but many parts of the world. We've got social media. Now, I'm actually all in favour of social media. Give me the choice between four rich white men that own the papers in the UK or 60 million nutters sending me tweets. I'll take the 60 million nutters every time. Because at last we managed to escape the idea that our media and the stories we hear about have been controlled for 100 years by particular ways of looking at the world, particular types of people that come from, particular type of institutions that have run things. Now, that's not saying they're bad people, it's not saying the news hasn't, some of them have been really interesting, but it comes with a particular take, a particular set of baggage, inevitably. I prefer the social media there, even though it comes with a lot of really major problems. But I think there are some real merits to opening up the space so that all sorts of people can have their voices heard. So I'm not opposed to social media, though I think we have to find somewhere trying to control some of its worst excesses. Sanders and Corbyn, not saying there's a good or bad. Well, I have my views, you can take your own pick on them. You know, these are people who have really radical positions. Sanders stood up and said he's a socialist and wasn't shot in America. That's quite an achievement. Corbyn, the PLP, the Labour Party, didn't like Corbyn. The BBC didn't like him. The Guardian didn't like him. Let alone the right. I mean, the Conservatives loathed him, and so did Telegraph. But no one supported Corbyn. But it's interesting how through social media he had been moderately successful and had quite an influence. The same thing with Sanders in the US. Brexit, Trump, whoever thought these things were going to happen? You go back to a year before each of these occurred, no one thought this is going to, this is just ridiculous. Of course we're not going to do that. We're not going to come out of the EU. Which idiot would ever put the vote forward anyway? And which idiot would vote for it? I'm not saying we're idiots by doing it, but that's what our sort of view would have been. Yeah, we had that. Who would vote for Trump? Who would vote for the Swedish Democrats, an ex-Nazi party in Sweden? 18% of people in Sweden voted for them. So there's a whole new anti-establishment constituency here. And actually, I'm really pleased they're voting. I'm not pleased they're voting for these people. And I was talking with Oliver earlier about this. I think, they're voting for these people because progressive lefties like me have not provided a good narrative for what a positive future looks like for these people in the Dust Belt or in the Rhondda Valley or the northeast of the UK who have had their industries decimated. So there's a whole scope of here, a new constituency who want to have their voices heard and want to see a new world. The Arab Spring, okay, ended up being a bloodbath, but I mean there were benefits out of their Arab Spring, new voices coming to the fore, continuing plummeting price of renewables. They're not yet showing any sign of bottoming out. Latest offshore round for offshore wind turbines is half the price of the last round. Now they've not delivered them yet, but if they do deliver them at that price, that's an incredible shift in the prices, which is already creating some instability in the market. And solar panels just keep coming down in price all the time, or solar power does. And also then there's concerns about fossil fuel impacts on health, which were not there before, and even the IMF are engaged in this. So there's a whole suite of these things there, and what I'm arguing is that in themselves these disruptions are important, but they're still sort of in isolation, they're evolutionary, they're not revolutionary. At the time they feel revolutionary, like the banking crisis, but what do? We found new ways to lightly regulate the banks and just wait for the next crisis. So the same people in charge, nothing really significant occurred. But at the time, it felt revolutionary, but it's turned out to be an evolutionary shift. But if you could align some of these things, if you could actually start to say, how do we bring some of these things together? Are there ways that we can manipulate the system? The we here is not going to be the establishment most of the time. Some of them perhaps, but are there ways that we can manipulate the system? And actually then maybe we could start to see something when you bring these together, whatever they might be, something much more revolutionary. I don't think the world is this static place that if you live in Oxford or Manchester, we go to university every day, it feels the same every day. There are big changes occurring all around us in all sorts of ways, but they're not aligned in any way, and some of them are obviously very bad as well. So could it be much more revolutionary? Most political and economic pontificators, this is just taken from the piece, buttressed by naysayers and established elites, remain incapable of seeing beyond their familiar 20th century horizon. And in universities, I would argue most of the time it's the 19th century, probably in Latin. But the 21st century is already proving how the future is a different country, one that could yet be shaped by alternative interpretations of prosperity, sustainability, and equity. So I think we are starting to see different stories, different narratives coming out. And again, it's our role to some extent to try and foster those if we are supportive of them. So do we have something to offer this new agenda? Are we prepared to think post-growth? I'm not saying degrowth. I prefer the idea of just moving away from the concept of growth at all, degrowth or post-growth. Just let's look at things in their own units, if you like. Don't have to see them as growing or shrinking. You know, I'd like to see more improved female literacy around the world. That's growth, but it doesn't really necessarily play out in economic growth. Be open-minded to technical opportunities, but also to their limitations. Consider short-term rationing of energy. Don't think there's a way around that. We have to be open about that. We have to deliver some sort of rationing. We can go away from the rationing later on once we've solved the problem, if it fits with other sustainability criteria, which it may or may not. But from a climate perspective, we have to ration it. I think we have to stand up to the bullying of the city and of the Davos set. And I would also say a really deep-seated tyranny that occurs within our universities. And I spoke in the piece I wrote coming back from Katowice this year, I spoke about that, having spoke to a lot of early career researchers who just said they daren't ask questions. They daren't ask questions at COP. They daren't ask questions of their supervisors. You know, what are we doing in universities if we're stopping younger voices who have not got the baggage that we've got yet speaking out? We should be, you know, really encourage them to speak out openly. I repeatedly hear that from early career researchers and people on short-term contracts, that they can't speak out openly against their established peers. So do we have the cogency, tenacity and courage to escape? And I tried all sorts of other words for this, but none of them really captured it. I don't think there's a neat way around it. I think we are, it's this sort of neoliberal black hole that we have. And depends how you look at that, sort of as a laissez-faire view of the world, sort of the current socioeconomic paradigm that's particularly dominant in the US and the UK, slightly less so in some of the European countries. You know, can we escape this way of looking at the world, this Davos sort of mindset? I think we probably can. So to conclude, in 2019, climate change is system change. It wasn't in 1990, we chose to fail. It wasn't in 2000, we carried on failing. By 2019, whether you take the Met Office budget, there's basically nothing left significant. So, you know, we are talking about taking the budgets and then asking questions of our norms and our paradigms. We have got to do the obvious, transform energy supply technologies. We have to do that. We need a rapid penetration of energy efficiency technologies. These things are really there. We can start to make those transitions today. And there are big issues around storage and intermittency to some extent and frequency control and all those things, but they're all resolvable in a reasonable time frame. This is probably very difficult. We need profound shifts in our behaviours and our practices. And I don't just mean tweaks. I mean, do we mean profound shifts in them? We need to reframe value, success, and progress. Why do we only see, you see success in celebrity, in stars, and successful business people? Not if you're a nurse looking after children with cystic fibrosis. That's not success. Why is that not success? Why are they paid, you know, £30,000 a year, and yet we pay some, you know, hedge fund manager or developer or whatever it might be, some huge salary, or even a professor? You know, why do I get paid more than a Virgin train driver? We've got to start to rethink what is important in our society and how we should be measuring those things. This is very difficult, and I would argue that's the case for sustainability, but in the short term, it's definitely the case for climate change. We need an economic model that's fit for purpose. I don't know what your various backgrounds are, but I come from an engineering background. If I was doing work on aerodynamics over a car, or even over my bike, if I'm going really fast, I'm going to use turbulent flow. If I'm going really slowly, I'm going to use laminar flow. I would never muddle the two up because it'd be meaningless. And yet in economics, the economic model we use is basically a general equilibrium, marginal economic model. No, it's about small changes near equilibrium. We're nowhere near equilibrium, and we're talking about step changes. So no other field of academic endeavor would ever use a model that was completely and utterly inappropriate to drive the framing of our agenda. And that's repeatedly what we do here. It's like using Newton to understand quantum mechanics. Why on earth are we doing that? There are plenty of good economic models out there with a much better framing, like ecological economics in its various forms, to address this issue. The current model is just not fit for purpose, and yet it dominates the debate. All of this has got to start now and be completed in about 3 decades. So it's, from an academic point of view, it's quite interesting, because I think the paper's blank to some extent. You know, we may know what the strategy is, but we don't really know what the policies look like, and they will be different between different countries. We've got a long way to go. Do we really care about these people when we think it's perfectly reasonable to have an increase in private yacht sales during the period of austerity? Yeah, during austerity, private yacht sales went up. Do we really care about our own future, own children's future, when we've got the Gates and the Virgins and the, what's his name, Musk, developing space travel, which I always sort of jokingly say I'm not completely against, as long as the tickets are one way. So, because you know, there are always people with high carbon footprints will always be on board. So I'm quite happy to see them go to Pluto. Do we care about future generations when we think it's perfectly reasonable to drive around in a 3 tons car? Yeah, you think about what could be in there. It could be me, I'm 83 kilograms of flesh in 3,000 kilograms of car, driving, 6 kilometers to pick up 10 kilograms of groceries. Is that a reasonable thing to do in 2019? And if it's a Tesla, it's still no better. You know, slightly less worse, perhaps. We've got migrants. What the first thing we do when we see migrants? We put up razor wire. And yeah, I regularly cycle past houses like this in Cheshire with lots of bedrooms that could fit in migrants. So, you know, are we really concerned about those sorts of things we're starting to see around us? Do we really worry about other species and other ecosystems? Well, EU is building a massive gas network now. And the Swedes, who hardly use any gas, are building a new gas terminal in Gothenburg to bring over shale gas from the rest of the world. So we're locking in a high carbon infrastructure right at this moment. The EU is spending our tax money, probably not Britain soon, but anyway, our tax money on building 2 massive gas pipelines. So really, really worry about the beauty of living this fantastic planet, the little blue dot in this inky darkness, when we merrily fly to another essential climate change conference or holiday in Bali. I do have quite a few discussions with Alex Stephan on Twitter, but I really like this quote he used here. Well, I think it's just one he made up. Winning slowly is basically the same thing as losing outright. In the face of both triumphant denialism and predatory delay, triumphant denialism is just what Trump does and some others, and I don't really care about them too much. And the predatory delay, that's what the climate progressives do. That's what we do as an academic community. We're always trying to find some way to delay action. And I think that's much more dangerous. Trying to achieve climate action by doing the same thing, the same old ways, means defeat. It guarantees defeat. And at the moment, just look at everything around us in terms of the aggregate impacts. Not the good things that go in here and there, but the aggregate impacts. Everything is pointing in the wrong direction. Emissions up again 2.7% in 2018. So we are guaranteeing defeat unless we start to think radically differently. But I'm trying to suggest, I think, and I know other people don't agree with me on this, I think we can still just have an outside chance of 2 degrees centigrade if we're prepared to address the political, social, and economic implications as well as the technical ones. So thanks for listening.
That was Professor Kevin Anderson, the Chair of Energy and Climate Change at the School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester. He spoke on January 25, 2019 at the Oxford Climate Society in the UK. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. This program was produced off the electric grid with solar power in the mountains of Northern California. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.